Good evening, Dave.
Oh, Steelman, so great to see you. Collared shirt tonight. You're looking handsome.
Yeah, it's got a half zip. It's like a Wisconsin-themed sweatshirt. But speaking of, I mean, my opening night of the NBA, Dave. Are you super excited for your Phoenix Suns?
Honestly, I'm pretty excited just about basketball in general. It's my favorite sport to watch. I'm in. And the Suns, I don't think they're going to be very good this year, no.
They broke up the Morris excited. Twins.
Yeah, I want to see what Markieff ends up doing this year. I feel like he's going to just absolutely melt down. There's something awesome that he's going to do this year.
Phoenix Suns, coached by the great Jeff Hornacek, and we have probably the one human being that reminds me most of Jeff Hornacek as a guest on our show this evening, Spencer Gardner. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. It's nice to be back. I've never been told that I remind anybody of Jeff Hornacek.
Didn't everybody call you horny in college? I thought that was the...
that was for totally different reasons.
Oh, okay.
Boom!
And Dave, man, this facial hair, is this how's this go all over in Snowflake? This looks pretty avant-garde for a town like Snowflake.
No, it's old school still. Snowflake, they love the mustache. I think I told you when I moved here, the first primary care doctor I met had a sweet mustache with the either end is about 4-inch long twist, just kind of straight point out the side of his face. So they trust the mustache for medical care here.
It's not the mustache that I'm asking about. It's the flavor saver.
Oh, yeah. You like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a little... If you're going to grow hair below the lip, it should be on the chin, is what I heard. That's the Snowflake rule.
Yeah, actually, I've gotten some comments today. A few people are uncomfortable with it. One person provided me a razor, but I'm just going to go forward. Yeah, I'm happy.
Is this the first time you've had hair growing below your lip, Dave?
Yes, on my entire body, actually. It finally sprouted, but it was
super
underneath
late
my lip.
Onset
I was
puberty.
Looking at other places.
Well, gentlemen, we have quite a podcast this evening in praise of youth, and it is decidedly youth-centric. But we wanted to start, before we get into our multiple discussion of child prodigies, wonderkinds, another off-the-chain debate, we've got Unchained Melodies, and we've got Book Wisdom. But first, we needed to update our listeners on our last assigned reading. Last time we had Spencer on, we did a special segment, assigned each other some reading assignments. And I thought we should start with the book that Spencer assigned to Dave, which I think you love, Dave. It was Bread and Wine.
It was super impressive. My wife, we bought the book and we decided, hey, let's read this together. After 2 months of trying and failing, my wife finally turned to me and just said, I can't do this anymore. Let's get a different book to read. I don't like any character in this book. I just can't do this. And then I said, okay, yeah, I'll take it. I'll just finish it on my own time. And I haven't done that, Steele.
Nice.
I haven't done it.
So this is the great Italian novel Spencer recommended as a great work of literary art, Bread and Wine by Ignazio Salone. You want to say a little bit about why you chose this book for Dave, Spence, and what its enduring values are?
Why did I choose this for Dave?
Yeah.
It was a book that I had on my mind at the moment. It wasn't like hand-selected. I think, oh, well, you know, Dave, this book and Dave go hand in hand. But as far as why it's an important book, you know, it's been a long time since I read it. The main message I got...
You're really selling it, Spence.
I wasn't selling it that well when I gave it to Dave either, so that's why it failed. No, it's the message that I remember most clearly is the failure of institutions. So this guy, Pietro Spina, goes into hiding as a like basically a Catholic priest, or I don't remember if it's a priest or what.
Yeah,
but he serves in this little tiny village, and he gets to know the peasants, and he's also a communist sympathizer, which is why he has to go into hiding. So his ideals are that, you know, the ordinary folk working out in the fields are like the paragon of society, and, you know, that the state will take care of these people. And basically comes out of it realizing that, you know, institutions fail and that the simple life is the way to go. I guess that's my summary.
So let me just share what I got from it. I know I didn't complete the book, but it was just another, you know, young idealist that's 20-something that thinks that he has all the answers to everything in the world. And you don't. I think that's kind of, I guess, maybe the point, but he felt like he knew everything. You don't know everything when you're 20. You're going to fail.
We'll get to this later, but there are some people that know everything when they're 20, Dave.
Yeah. Yeah, we are going to cover that later. But, you know, I think the biggest failing of this book, Spencer, the thing you failed to consider, there was not enough interplanetary slavery. And Dave will not go for a book unless there's at least 3 or 4 alien races subjugating each other.
That's true.
That's true. Where's the technology? Where's the future? At the very least, throw me some magic, Spence. Come on.
Well, that was Bread and Wine. I did read it, Spence. I read a couple books in this trilogy and was halfway through the third one. And I did like him. We'll have to talk about him off the air sometime, but I was impressed.
Thank you still. That makes me feel better about myself.
I still like you, Spence. And maybe I'll finish the book one of these days. I'll get there.
It's all right, Dave. You keep working on growing that hair on your chin.
Do it, Dave. Well, the second book we had to review was Brandon Sanderson's fantasy classic, Warbreaker. And this, I think Dave noted earlier, for its great cover. You were riding public transportation and just getting all kinds of unwanted attention from the cover.
Yeah, any cover art of any actual Brandon Sanderson novel is going to blow people away. Anyone that you're sitting next to is going to kind of scoot away from you just a little bit after seeing what's on the cover. But still, once you open up what's inside, that's where the payoff really is. This is my tip for Spence. Is Steele, I think he thought about me for a minute and he's like, yeah, Dave might like this book. And Steele was right. I loved it. This guy is top-notch fantasy. I don't think he's breaking any molds or doing anything too different, but he keeps just building really interesting worlds and just takes a really interesting idea and goes with it and thinks, like, what would the world be like if you could harness the color, the power of color? And then he goes and he does it.
So this one was a success, Dave.
It's like, what, 600 pages? I blew through it. I've read 3 Brandon Sanderson novels since then.
So it's a toss-up about whether you like Bread and Wine or Warbreaker more, is what you're saying?
Yeah, it's a close call. If I had to choose one, I really couldn't choose between the two, but I highly recommend both. But Brandon Sanderson, if you're kind of a nerdy guy, you like fantasy or even science fiction, open it up and you're going to be happy. I was. Thank you, Steele.
You're welcome. Thank you. Glad you're assigned reading. Was such a pleasure. So what are you reading right now? Mistborn? Is that the trilogy that you're in?
Yeah, I read all 3 of Mistborn. I thought that was great. I'm kind of taking a break now from fantasy just to kind of bring myself back to not super nerddom. I want to come back to literature a little bit. So I'm reading The Road right now, actually.
And that's going to feature in our book wisdom at the end of the episode, I think.
Yeah, if I can get through it without crying.
All right, Dave, you recommended a book for Spencer. You want to give us the 30-second description of what this book was and why you recommended it?
I love it. It's about an American citizen that was living in Moscow in the 50s and ended up being taken prisoner. They basically trumped up charges of being a spy, and he spent the next couple decades in prison in the gulag. And it's just an inspirational story of how this guy survived that ordeal. What do you think, Spence?
It gets a big thumbs up from me, Dave. I liked it. I think I have 1 or 2 chapters left, so I'm getting close to the end. It's fascinating. It's crazy, the stuff that he went through, especially the torture towards the beginning. They kept him in prison for, I don't remember how long, it was nearly a year or maybe more than a year in various Soviet prisons that were not very good places to be, and they tortured him. Sleep deprivation, you know, physical pain, solitary confinement, all these things. And he describes in great detail these little ways that he's able to maintain his sanity. So
the guy is named Alexander Dolgin, is that right?
That's right.
And the book was called American in the Gulag.
Yeah.
So he's an American citizen, and people know that he's held prisoner by the Russians, or do they know he's disappeared, or what does the American government or his family know during all this time?
I'm trying to remember, because he eventually gets a letter from his mother, I think.
Oh, wow.
I think they know he's there. He's kind of a lower level functionary in the embassy, so it's not like he's a super high profile American citizen or anything like that. And he also had lived in Moscow for a long time had gone there when his father was taking work there, I think even before the Second World War. So it wasn't like he had just been plucked from the streets of New York and thrown into a prison in Moscow or something. Wow.
But he was essentially plucked from the streets of Moscow. They didn't know where he was for quite a long time during this torture phase. And eventually once they're done interrogating, that's when they send him out to the gulag, and he has to survive in just harrowing circumstances there too. Just the fact that this man could overcome that was so impressive.
And he learns medicine so that he can be the equivalent of a nurse, I guess, in the prison system.
Holy cow.
As a way to get a better job.
Male nursing, it will take you places, Spence.
It will.
Way to make lemonade, you know, when life gives you lemons. And Spencer, you and I had book recommendations for each other. I think we should probably talk about them together because they're written by buddies and the books are kind of similar. I recommended Daniel Kahneman, a behavioral economist book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And you recommend Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book to me. And I started actually by reading Fooled by Randomness. That's the one that I read.
That's one that I have not read, but I can guess at what he talks about based on the other books. So.
Yeah, I felt like it was a blast. The book was kind of irreverent, super intelligent, non-conventional thinker, but really just kind of turning conventional wisdom on its head and saying, hey, here's how we can harness the flaws in human decision-making to think and act better. Mm-hmm. And don't necessarily just believe in something because the herd of people believe in it. Let's consider our reasons and our rationale. And sometimes we behave anti-rationally and we try to project patterns onto just random behavior or random patterns.
Yeah. And it's interesting in reading the other books that I've read from him, you read something that he explains and then it's like, well, that makes total sense. But up to that point, it's not been a factor in your decision making. So yeah, I think it's irreverent, kind of a little bit like very funny book, and he pulls no punches towards certain professions that he does not like, which I find entertaining. But a very insightful book, yeah.
Yeah, I guess one of the big takeaways for me is this. It's a term that I learned about not too long ago. It's called pareidolia. Have you heard of this, Dave?
No, sir.
It's a psychological phenomenon where when you have a bunch of input coming in, you'll believe that you see a familiar pattern where there is no actual pattern. So sometimes when people look at a piece of toast and see the Virgin Mary, or they'll hear a bunch of random sounds and they believe there's like a hidden message in them, it's because we want to project the presence of patterns or meaning onto meaninglessness, as like our human psychological mind is organized in that way. And so this happens a lot with art, with religious phenomenon, and with the way that humans interpret random information. And so what he's kind of cautioning you against is, don't be fooled by randomness, and the stock market is essentially random. So if you think you can predict it, you're crazy.
Yeah.
But that's kind of also a beautiful aspect of life, that we do search for those kind of patterns and meanings. That gives music and poetry and all that kind of stuff way more individual meaning to the people consuming it, because you're seeing stuff in it that applies to you.
And his major point is, it's beautiful and it's wonderful in those spheres of aesthetic appreciation of art and music. But when you try to bring it to finance or make laws and rules based on it, you're crazy and you're going to fail. And I thought that was a really powerful kind of message.
That's true.
How about you, Spence? Thinking Fast and Slow?
Yeah, that was your book to me. This was by Daniel Kahneman, who is a professor of behavioral psychology. I don't know. He was kind of one of the founders of behavioral economics.
Uh-huh.
So famous academic, but the major theme was that we have two different systems for thinking. Our brains employ kind of two different thought processes. And the first, which he calls system one, it's intended for very fast reactions and fast processing of information. And that's this pattern seeking thing.
Like snap judgments.
Yes, it's snap judgments. We're trying to minimize the amount of time and the amount of energy that we put into assessing the world around us. And so that's why when you hear a sound at night and you're out, you know, walking on a dark street or something, your mind initially jumps to some conclusions about what that sound might be. And then he talks about level two thinking, which is a more deliberate, slow, rational form of thinking. And then most of the book is just explanations of how our system one and our system two are sometimes at odds with each other. But system one, because it's designed to be the first kind of the gatekeeper, often overrules or I guess preempts our system two thinking. And so that can carry over into all kinds of spheres where we end up making poor decisions based on those snap judgments without realizing that we're not actually doing the harder, more deliberate thinking of a level two.
Mm. So is he saying, are there emotions involved in these snap judgments, or is this just still just your brain just doing this?
Well, I think emotion would be tied up, especially in system one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the point was that a lot of it's precognitive, before we're even aware. Like we're deciding, we've got a heuristic or a rubric, and we're just fitting information into it, and we're not even aware that we're deciding or thinking about it. We've already done it before we're even conscious of it. It's like super fast. It's like pre-attentive.
Yeah, so it's like your system two basically has to deliberately overrule your system one, because your system one, before you've even thought it, has already come up with the thought that you're going to have.
Mm.
Like your guys' system one thoughts couldn't control loving the hair that's underneath my lip. But when you brought it to your system two, you had to consider what that means to you. So you had to then insult me.
Yeah, it was a psychological defense mechanism, really. I'm a hairless man and Spencer's got the full beard. So, of course, we don't understand.
You never will.
Hey, and Dave, if you could keep bringing that cup up and do it a little closer to the mic. I think it's adding a lot to the podcast.
It's Tang, actually, Steele.
Ah, well then.
Of course it's Tang. You've moved on from Kool-Aid, right, Dave?
Well, this is our podcast's first sponsor. This episode brought to you by Tang. If it's good enough for astronauts, it's good enough for off the chain.
It's got a vitamin C. It's got all the things Kool-Aid's lacking. It's right here.
But all the sugar to get it down your throat easier.
Which is, that's important. Yeah, that's important to my palate.
It's got to taste good.
One out of one male nurse in Snowflake, Arizona recommends Tang.
That's doctor of male nursing. So
okay. Hey, well, speaking of cognitive freaks and our thinking processes, we have a very special segment today. It's one that's been on my mind for quite some time, and it is something called Wunderkinder, child prodigies. I've been thinking about these a ton lately, in that there seem to be some fields where you can have child prodigies, which means this is like a kid who's a teenager or under, who's like world class at something. And there's other fields where they almost never happen. It's true of art. It's true of science. And I wanted to discuss a little bit about some of the fields that have child prodigies in them. And so I wanted to kind of just open this up for general discussion. A field that you think is notable for the presence of child prodigies?
You got to go acting. I mean, we've all been entertained by The Sixth Sense. Without that kid, you were never going to understand that Bruce Willis was actually dead during that whole film. And I'm grateful for these child actors. They're able to push forward a plot and a story that I really need, such as Bruce Willis being dead the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of child prodigy, in the field of acting, the ones that really come to my mind, the Olsen twins, revolutionized the craft, I would say. You couldn't
and
tell them apart.
Could be comedic prodigies as well, because they were hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, you didn't know there were two of them until the media told you. That's how good at acting they were. You thought they were playing the same character really well. Obviously, Will Smith's kids, Jaden, seriously, that kid has deep thoughts.
Yes. Have you guys seen the Karate Kid remake with Jaden Smith?
Nope.
Fantastic. Amazing.
This
He's
is just word of mouth.
As good as
that
Ralph Macchio.
Oh, yeah? Another child prodigy.
Almost as good as Ralph Macchio is what I would say in my review of that film.
I first off think of Macaulay Culkin.
Oh, yeah. Carried the Home Alone franchise.
The hands to the face and the scream with the aftershave.
Yeah.
Priceless.
When I grow up and get married, I'm living alone. I've been saying that for years.
But what's really interesting is when one of these child prodigies can actually continue their career going onward.
Like
Justin Timberlake.
Oh, let's talk about music, because that's where the child prodigies often have a career. We were talking about Macaulay Culkin, obviously the king of pop, MJ, child prodigy, and continued making music as an adult.
a savant of music, I believe. I have several of his records. They're fantastic.
Yeah, and it wasn't just musically, though. I mean, he as a child, he knew how to command the stage. The guy had stage presence as like a six-year-old.
Yeah.
Charisma.
Mozart was a famous musical prodigy. He started composing at the age of five.
What about Beethoven? Was he a child when he composed?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know much about Beethoven's child accomplishments.
Was Doug? Was that his first name?
Yeah, Doug Beethoven.
Yeah.
He was brilliant. And what about, we all like sports here.
Yeah,
child prodigies in sports. You watch the Olympics and it's just child prodigy after child prodigy, ice skating, gymnastics.
Especially gymnastics.
You have to be like a 13-year-old girl to do anything in the gymnastics world.
Yeah.
And Freddie Adu?
Yep.
I remember that being big news.
14-year-old soccer player. Yeah. He didn't make much of himself as an adult.
Yeah.
No, I'll read. Do you read those every once in a while? There'll be like an article that come across, like update on Freddie Adu, and it's just sad. It's like he's playing in Colombia somewhere on like a third division team, and it just keeps getting worse for that guy.
He's working for a Slovakian goat herd, but hopes to return to the game soon.
And that seems to be a theme for me with a lot of these child prodigies. Is things end up going very poorly as they age.
Case in point, child prodigy in terms of use of the Force, the great Anakin Skywalker. Look how things turned out for him.
He was corrupted by the dark side so easily.
Yeah, and then he got his hand cut off.
But honestly, why do you think that's the case? I mean, you have others listed here like Bobby Fischer, Tiger Woods, any of those actors we were talking about. And Michael, I'm sorry to say, Michael Jackson, things didn't turn out well for him.
Arthur Rimbaud, the French poet, revolutionized French poetry and quit poetry by the age of 21. Died of cancer in his 30s after a crazy, dissolute life. We got John Keats, dead at 25. We've got, I don't know, who else flamed out and struggled?
Kurt Cobain.
Yeah. There was this guy, I don't know if anybody's heard of him, William James Sidis. He was like a Harvard math professor by the age of 18. He became obsessed with public transportation timetables and then died really sad in his 40s after, basically, he just became a weird recluse.
There's probably no way to die happy if your obsession is public transportation timetables.
No, but he wrote a couple books about it. So he calculated how you could travel from like one coast to the other on a set of interchangeable transfers, how it was possible with buying one fare. This guy was into it.
And then you look at Doogie Howser. Once he achieved medical fame, his television show got canceled. He couldn't keep it going.
Yeah, great point. There's something about this, and I don't know whether we're talking about savants, being people who are savants, who are kind of idiots in ordinary life, but super exceptional in one field, or whether being a child prodigy, you attract all this attention for excellence in one field, and you just fail to develop the normal social abilities and competencies and friendships, and then it just ruins you as an adult. I don't know.
I think you can see it in these fields where they achieve fame. Like, clearly, it's that kind of thing happening. You're getting too much attention when you're young. You're not developing some of the skills that you're going to need as you age to deal with disappointment and failure, because you're 8 years old and everything's working out for you.
I think of the cautionary tale of Steve Urkel as probably a great example of this.
Urkel.
You mean Urkel or Jaleel White, the actor that played Urkel?
No, it was not an actor, Spence. You have your facts incorrect. Steve Urkel was a real person.
Then he started.
I had a different family matters in mind.
Yeah.
He started doing his genetic experiments. He would go in there and come out as a cool guy sometimes. Things just, it spiraled out of control really quickly.
Yeah. Wasn't that guy named Stefan?
Yeah, Stefan. Yes. Fortunately, he had a police officer next door to kind of keep him in line.
That's
Carl
right.
Carl Winslow.
But did Laura and Steve ever get together? Did that happen? It doesn't seem like that would happen.
She was into Stefan.
Yeah, she was way into Stefan.
That's so hard. That's got to be so hard for Steve.
Yeah, see, that's another thing. When you excel in some areas, it's difficult, I think, to balance the demands of romance. I can't imagine that Bobby Fischer has had a lot of satisfying romantic relationships.
I can't imagine that he's had a lot of human relationships of any kind.
That's true. Gary Kasparov, maybe. Deep Blue.
Yeah, Deep Blue. So, that's his secret lover.
So, Steele, what do you think is the unifying thing of these fields where you can have a child prodigy?
Okay, so I did a bit of reading about this, and there's a couple of people who've written books, but basically fields in which child prodigies can exist tend to be either verbally based or rule-based domains, like math, like music, like engineering or computer science, where it's a set of rules that can be manipulated mentally. Those are the fields where they excel. And there's a theory right now that almost all child prodigies have abnormally large short-term working memory capacity. So they're able to hold a large number of facts or figures or ideas in their short-term working memory. And that's kind of what makes them prodigious. It's not necessarily abnormal intelligence, but really high short-term working memory. I don't know about the athletic prodigies, but that's the theory for the kind of intellectual fields.
I was really hoping that it would end with abnormally large heads, but it unfortunately didn't.
Because then Trevor Weed would have been a great candidate for prodigy of the year.
And then my three daughters would all be, it'd be child prodigy time.
Well, do you have hope that your kids are going to be prodigies in any like particular field? If you could pick a child prodigy field, what would you want your kids to excel at?
Banjo, cello, and like the gut bucket maybe?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know
a
what
little
that's
musical.
Called. But just a nice little bluegrass trio I think I'd be happy with.
The Snowflake Sisters?
but honestly, I wouldn't want my kids to be a child prodigy. I think it brings a lot of pressure and a lot of negatives, and it seems like you can have a pretty dissatisfying rest of your life if your childhood you're a prodigy.
Not so for spelling. I kind of want my son to be a spelling prodigy. I think you basically guaranteed to turn out all right if you win a spelling bee. No arguments there, huh?
No, what can we say to that? That's just truth. I think that's generally accepted.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be fun also to talk about fields in which no child prodigies do exist. So I was thinking about super unlikely to have a child prodigy fiction writer. When's the last time you saw a great novel written by an 8-year-old?
Yeah, they shouldn't even try. Come on.
But it is interesting that you can have child prodigy poets, because poetry is somewhat more rule-based and involves sometimes meter or rhyme. So there are sometimes young prodigy poets, but almost never young prodigy novelists.
I thought poetry didn't involve rhyme.
Well, I mean, it used to.
Okay.
And just going back to the debate that Steele feels like I lost, but I won. Poems rhyme. A little hearkening back. So I started to try and think of some too, and I just thought of fields where if you're 8, you're never going to have any interest in this field. And the first thing I thought was podiatry. You're not going to walk in to the podiatrist's office with your horrible toes, and then it's a 12-year-old like, what can we do for you today?
That's true. Super unlikely to have child prodigy podiatrists.
So you'd go more like the Doogie Howser route, like General MD, or?
Yeah.
I don't even know what Doogie's field was. He seemed like he did everything. I think Doogie just covered all the bases. He was just going to do a residency in everything.
Yeah. I think he had to for TV purposes. Another field, you're never going to see a child prodigy psychologist. I just think there's too much to understand about human nuance, emotion, thought to really have, like, you walk into your office and, ooh, it's a 12-year-old Dr. Freud. It's not going to happen.
No. You're not going to have a 12-year-old politician.
No.
Maybe like an 18-year-old mayor. That could maybe happen, but it's not going to work well.
A little too complex.
Yeah.
There are certain fields for which physical restrictions would probably get in the way, like a roller coaster safety technician.
Yeah. Weightlifter. You're not going to have a child prodigy weightlifter, although that would be kind of amazing.
Some kids get way into it. Go on YouTube. You'll see it. Yeah, there's some kids that are super ripped. So that may not actually be true. Sorry,
okay,
Steele.
I'm wrong. I was just hopeful.
You had written American football, and I don't know if you've seen the film Little Giants.
Okay.
There's some prodigies
again,
on that.
I'm an idiot. Proven wrong.
I mean, I don't want to make you feel bad, but
film directoring. or directory. Well, film directory, you just can't do that as a youngin.
There's actually not a whole lot of people in the field of film directoring at all. So yeah, you're not going to get a lot of children in there.
Not sure if I can name one.
Although I don't know. I mean, that would be kind of cool to see what kind of films kids make if you taught them the rudimentary basics of holding a camera and editing.
Why not?
Surrealist.
So when I was thinking about this and when we were kind of going back and forth about it, what I got the most excited about was fields where I'd like to see some child prodigies.
This was probably the one that I laughed at most. I even shared him with Laurel. She laughed at half a dozen, and that's a high bar because most of the time she's not super impressed with our theme ideas. So let's start this off. Spencer, you had some great ideas.
Yeah, well, this one has been fictionalized, but espionage. The kids, no one will suspect kids.
Child spies. I thought motivational speaking. And Laurel told me that this is real. There's a little African-American kid who's called the Lil' President, who's like a YouTube sensation, and I guess he's a politician / motivational speaker. But we need more of them. We need more like 4-year-old motivational speakers.
One that I liked, it's difficult with the legality of child labor, but come on, how about some like an 8-year-old plumber or a roofer coming over? That's just fantastic.
Just leaning back, scratching his back. I think what you need here, get some plumbum and some elbow grease, and that would be great.
You're going to have to solder that connection.
Another one that would be amazing, a child prodigy food critic. You'd have a million reviews of macaroni and cheese.
That peanut butter sandwich it was too moist.
There's a little too much crust had been left on. I told my mom explicitly, I do not like crust. Fail. 0 stars.
But Spence, when has a peanut butter sandwich ever been too moist? It's the dryness that's always the problem. You're trying to chew with the peanut butter. You want moisture.
But wait, if you get the jam right, Dave, then, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, I'm thinking, keep this up, guys. Let's give us more of your thoughts on peanut butter and jelly reviews.
You just got to get the jam ratio to bread correct. If you don't put enough jam, it's going to be too dry.
This is why we need more child prodigies in the field.
I was actually a child prodigy food critic, so we've already disproved that one.
Any other fields that we would love to see more child prodigies?
I think morticians. We need more child morticians.
When I shared that one to Laurel, she made a face and said, no, you can't do that one. She thought that was cruel.
My favorite one, reading this list at work, I just started giggling. I don't even know if it's funny, but I couldn't stop laughing. Speedboat pilots.
Yes, that one was my suggestion. I'm glad it went over so well. Oh, man, you hire a 7-year-old to run some drugs across the Florida Keys.
That sounds like Dan Jennajohn's favorite movie in the making.
Except drugs aren't funny.
No, but child prodigy speedboat pilots are amazingly funny.
The other one I think would be a real big hit, advice columnists.
Yes, absolutely.
I would read a child prodigy advice columnist.
How to be a good parent.
And or conservative radio host. I don't know who suggested that one. Talk radio.
My favorite. Dave, I think that was you, but that was my favorite.
Wow.
It'd be so good. Did you guys ever read that internet comic called Axe Cop? Are you guys familiar with that?
No.
It was drawn by like a guy in his 20s. And it was written by his 5-year-old little brother. So just the panels, it's just kind of nonsensical. The little brother came up with the character Axe Cop, a cop that carries an axe. And just each successive episode is just fantastic.
That sounds great. This is lends credence to my idea that there should be more child prodigy film directors.
Exactly.
Give them a budget. Give them a Hollywood set. Can't be worse than some of the schlock that comes out.
Hey, one man's schlock is another man's pitch black.
Hey.
Don't go there. Hey, Dave loves that. No.
Don't even go near Diesel. Come on.
Dave and I have a longstanding disagreement about that movie.
All right. Well, we've covered a little bit about child prodigies who achieve their success too early and go on to fail in later life. And I think we have, this is a nice connection to our most recent flavor of off-the-chain debate, Picasso or Cezanne. And I don't know who wants to explain this one, but it's a great idea.
I'll explain it. So there's an economist from the University of Chicago named David Galenson who theorized that there are two types of creative minds. There's what he called the old masters, and then there are the young geniuses. So the old masters would be artists or performers or whatever the creative endeavor is, who hone their craft over a lifetime. And so their best years end up being towards the end of their creative life. Mm. Whereas the young geniuses have a short burst of intense creativity, and then they kind of peter out. And he uses Picasso and Cezanne as examples, because Picasso was a prodigious artist, but most of his best known and most important work happened at the beginning of his career.
Yeah, sure.
And Cezanne was the opposite. His most famous and most important paintings happened towards the end of his career. So he uses those as kind of the shortcut terms for the old masters and young geniuses.
Well, we have some important names. We want to run through them. This is going to be off the chain debate. The first, Picasso or Cezanne, the king of pop himself, Michael Jackson.
Guys, I think he burned out. He's my Picasso. He burned so brightly that he just couldn't keep it up. His craft, as he got further on in life, just everything got too complex. He worked too hard. He just didn't have the creativity anymore. He lost it. He's a Picasso.
So at what point do you think he started that downward trend?
We can all say that Dangerous was his last great album. So what was he then, like maybe 30 or late 20s?
Okay. I would say it's the marriage to Lisa Marie. That was what really doomed him.
Yeah, that's what happened to Elvis as well.
He had
he married his daughter? Come on, he didn't do that.
What was that song from Free Willy?
Hold me like the River Jordan, I will then say to thee, you my friend. That probably was his last good song. That's a good point.
Yeah, because that came a little while after. He was mid-30s by that point?
He had History, that big album. It was mostly greatest hits. But, yeah, past, present, and future.
So he's a Picasso? Are we decided
95.
On that?
Guess I mean, it's a debate,
he's
Spence.
A Picasso. There's no debate here. He's a Picasso. Look at his last several records, and you'll see basically garbage. Look at what he did up until he was 30, and it's probably the greatest pop music ever made.
Okay. This one's going to divide opinion, I'm sure. Sly Stallone. Picasso, young genius, or late bloomer?
Guys, once again, I have the correct opinion here. Stallone is definitely a Cezanne.
Late bloomer.
He wrote Rocky after he was 30 years old. He'd done nothing with his life beforehand. Then he wrote and directed an Oscar-winning film. And what he's done is just kept getting better. Look at the progression from Rocky 1 to Rocky 6. Amazing. And look at the work he's doing with the Expendables now. The man's a Cezanne.
So you'd put the Expendables above Rocky?
I think everyone would, Spence.
I think on this one, Dave is demonstrably wrong. I've seen a couple, maybe 1.5 Sylvester Stallone movies, but even I know that John Rambo is way better than the plastic surgery mangled guy from Expendables. I don't even know his name.
But still,
over the top.
Even if you think those things are ridiculous, his real acting career didn't start till he was in his 30s. It wasn't like
he
was rocking
his
20.
It's his young genius phase rather than his late bloomer. He's not a late bloomer. He's a late witherer.
Yeah, he's been on his way out, Dave.
He's a star on the wane.
Guys, what would you say about a pop star whose first hit song was after they were 30 years old?
Great
job. Would you say that they were a late bloomer, or would you say that they were using their youngness?
Young genius.
I'd have to look at it in the context of the rest of their work.
Man, Spencer's always got to be precise and careful. All right. Young genius or late bloomer? This is a political one. Hillary Clinton.
remains to be decided, I think. Is she going to make it through this election, Steele?
It seems likely. I don't think Bernie Sanders is a real challenger, but we can dream.
Yeah, but he's got sweet hair.
And that guy, that's our Cezanne, Bernie
Sanders.
That's
a good point, yeah.
I think he's gonna pull it through here. Yeah.
Okay, let's move over to the sports world of sports here. We got a couple of good ones, but the big one that everybody wants to know about, this is a pretty tricky one, Peyton Manning, record-setting performance at the University of Tennessee. We've got early career Manning with the Colts, and then we have Renaissance late career Denver Bronco Peyton Manning.
That's a tough one.
And it seems like in the world of sports, how could you be anything but a Picasso? You burn brightly through your 20s. If you're still going in your 30s, I guess you could argue for a Cezanne. Yeah, I mean, I guess you couldn't compare this to Sylvester Stallone, and because just the different time frame of being an athlete compared to being an actor.
But Peyton's, is he not having like some of the best seasons of his career in Denver?
Yeah, statistically, him and Brady, I think, both.
Not this year, guys. He's having his statistically worst season by far. He is doing very poorly.
So he's a Picasso. We've settled it. Picasso. Peyton Manning's a Picasso. Okay, this one I know you have a strong opinion on, Dave. Madonna?
She's a Picasso. Still, like, she's still hanging on, and that's wonderful that she still somehow has it. But it's all from this energy that she bottled in her 20s with Like a Virgin and whatever her other hits are. They were fantastic. And
Vogue.
And Vogue. Everyone loves Vogue.
Like a Prayer.
Like a Prayer. You got more?
Oh, yeah. All of Madonna's hits. Although I will say Ray of Light. I mean, it might cancel out several of the early career Madonna hits.
And she did Evita, right?
Yeah, and she's also become a leader in the field of Kabbalah studies. So she's got going for her. Yeah, Jewish mysticism. I mean, don't underestimate contributions to a field outside of music.
Well, couldn't she be both a Picasso and a Cezanne? A Picasso in the world of music and a Cezanne in Jewish mystical studies?
Now that is a worthy thought. Let's ponder that one for a few weeks. Okay, so those are the big ones that I wanted to hit early on, but I know there's a couple more. Anyone want to toss out another one for us to debate here?
Yeah, Ron Howard.
I would say he's a clear Cezanne. He was lovable as a young kid, but he was also terrible. Opie, I mean, not a great artistic accomplishment.
You just made Emmeline your worst enemy, Steele.
I know.
But are you just completely disregarding Happy Days? What about Happy Days?
What is Happy Days?
That was brilliant.
The Fonz carried that show. Ron Howard was the square.
Yeah, but he had girlfriends, though. Like, he was always on a date, and the Fonz always was impressing his date. So he was doing something.
Good job on being a heterosexual teenager, Ron Howard. I mean, come on, Dave. That doesn't make you a Picasso.
Yeah, you're probably right. You guys probably haven't seen the race car movie that he directed from like a year or two ago, but it's fantastic.
Herbie?
Really good. Even better. It was about European Formula One racing, and really a quality, interesting film. I wish I remembered what it was off the top of my head.
I got to get out more.
Yeah, you know, it's a topic that really enthralls Spencer and I, European Formula One racing. Any chance we have to see a fictionalization of those events is just double thumbs up from us.
So here's one I got for you guys. Splinter, the rat from the Ninja Turtles.
Which do you include the cartoons in your consideration of Ninja Turtles lore?
Yes, the whole character, everything that's ever been done with this rat that was maybe once a man. I'm not sure.
That's a tough one. I haven't seen the cartoons and stuff, so I just know the movies. He was pretty amazing in the original Ninja Turtles. I don't know if he could ever top that.
Yeah, so I'm wondering how to answer this, because it seems like even though the early Ninja Turtle movies were made in the 90s, the new ones are made in the same universe, so Splinter is roughly the same age. I think what we're being asked to consider here is not early film version of Splinter or late film version of Splinter, but the human ninja master who existed before this mutant ooze, and the rat being who was fused with the Ninja Master after the Ninja Master's betrayal and death. That's the late career Splinter. Early career Splinter is the fully human Ninja Master before the betrayal. And it's a tough question because I don't think I know enough about pre-Mutant Ooze Splinter. What was his name? What were his great accomplishments? He may well have been a Picasso. I just don't know enough to say.
I don't think he was actually human, though.
Wasn't there a human?
Well, he was his owner or his master was the ninja guy, and Splinter just trained alongside him.
Mm.
So that's where he got his martial arts expertise. But when the ooze came along, it didn't change him. He was just a rat that grew into a man-sized rat.
So Spencer's going to answer this question literally by saying, pre-ooze rat versus post-ooze rat, there's no comparison. The rat was way better after the ooze, clearly Cezanne. But well, I'm taking the view that like his master could be considered Splinter pre-ooze. And then post-ooze Splinter is the comparison we have to make. And I'm saying that pre-ooze master is the Picasso potentially. And that's just, I mean, my opinion out there.
No, I don't think there's any way, Steel. That's just wrong. See, the cowabunga at the end of the first movie is like the pinnacle of Splinter.
Yeah.
And at that point, he was certainly in his Cezanne phase.
He was a rat.
I think that wins the debate.
Yep.
Well, I did my best. So, big important question. Bill Gates. Where do you come down on Bill Gates? Picasso or Cezanne?
I'd say he's a little bit nerdy. Not the coolest guy. That doesn't necessarily affect his status. But no, I think he's clearly a Picasso. He got to do all this amazing computer programming as a teen, became an expert in computers, and then was able to build a really powerful company. If you went to him now, he'd probably know very little about computers, and he hasn't done anything in the computer world for years and years.
So
I think he's a Cezanne.
Because of the Gates Foundation?
Well, I think that's part of it. So he started out as a teenager, you know, coding in school or whatever he was doing in Seattle. But the fact that he was able to take that and then build the largest company in the world at the time and the most important software company in the world, I think that takes more than just an initial flash of brilliance. I mean, he started out with this thing, and obviously he had help from other people, but he started out with this with Microsoft, you know, the operating system, and that was, you know, I think that was an initial flash of brilliance, but it got better from there because he learned, he took it from the like nerdy coding phase into an actual viable business and then grew that into what we know today as Microsoft. I think that really takes a lifetime of skill.
So here are the terms of the debate for me, and it's less, so I acknowledge what both of you are saying. I think of early career Gates as the nerd computer guy who built Microsoft. That's his great accomplishment in the Picasso phase, is building an enormous computer software company, the thing that he did that's most significant, or is it late career Gates Foundation giving away billions of dollars for philanthropic causes, for health and other public stuff around the world, transforming the world through charitable giving, or building a software company, which is his great life accomplishment?
Well, he couldn't do the second one without having first accomplished the first.
But lots of people did the first but don't do the second. That's what I'm saying.
That's true. But he had to do the first very well to get that much money. But yeah. Really, he's just an impressive man. It's fantastic that he would choose to do that with the rest of his life when, yeah, there are people that have made billions of dollars. Like we talked about his buddy Steve Ballmer last week. What did he do with his billions? He bought the Clippers and yells a lot.
He's not moving the needle on malaria in Africa. That's all we'll say. Well, that was a great debate. And we've talked about child prodigies. We've talked a little bit about Picasso versus Cezanne. Now it's time for a very special edition of Unchained Melodies. The theme, as we said, was In Praise of Youth. And first we wanted to start with amazing songs recorded by teenagers, pre-20-year-old musicians.
So this one was one that came to mind before we had listed Michael Jackson in other areas, but Jackson 5 ABC, it's a classic piece of music, and I think a budding wunderkind in the making.
So how old was Michael when they recorded this? Do you have any idea?
I don't actually know.
Okay, we'll come back to that after we play the song, but here's ABC by the Jackson 5.
Never do this more. I hate, I'm only accepted.
So I did some digging. That song came out in 1970. Jackie Jackson, the oldest member of the group, was 19.
Oh,
Michael
boy.
Was 12.
Yeah. Michael, the Wunderkind, was 12. Tito was 17. Jermaine was like 15. Marlon was 14, 13. I mean, teenagers making world-class music. That's an impressive example, Spencer. I think that's definitely off the chain.
Guys, you're wondering, how can we possibly follow that up? And there's only one way. That's with Hanson, with their great contribution, a word I just made up, to music, mbop.
I'll say in that song's defense, that's aged really well. That's a pretty gorgeous piece of pop music. I know it's ironic and laughable, but that's not bad.
No, like you sincerely, you put that on the list as a suggestion for me, and I thought long and hard. I was thinking about all these teenage bands. It's like, no, this wins. This is genuinely really pretty good.
And their
See, Dave, I know you. I can make good recommendations. What were you saying, Spencer?
The hair in the video, their hair is just amazing. All three of them.
Yeah. Where are those guys from? Are they from Jersey? Is that right, Dave?
They're from Canada.
It looks like Tulsa, Oklahoma is where they're from.
Yeah, we were real close, though, Spence.
Right from the heart of the country, guys. To rock like that, you got to be coming from the heart of America.
So I had a bunch of kind of thoughts. I was thinking, the first thought I had was Silverchair. Do you remember these guys, the Australian teenagers that came out with that Frog Stomp album?
So
that
good.
One I thought was pretty awesome when I was a young kid. And then I thought Lorde, the new singer-songwriter, I think she's like 16 when she came out with Royals. But the one that I think is totally worth playing, I can't believe this. I think about this, how young and how talented. The English folk singer-songwriter Laura Marling released her album Alas, I Cannot Swim 3 days after her 18th birthday. And this is the opening song off that record. It's called Ghosts.
He walked down a busy street, staring solely at his feet, clutching pictures of past lovers at his side. Stood at the table where she sat and removed his hat in respect of her presence. Presents her with the pictures and says, these are just ghosts that broke my heart before I met you. These are just ghosts that broke my heart before I met you. Opened up his little heart, unlocked the lock that kept it dark. Read a written warning, saying I'm still mourning. Over ghosts, over ghosts, over ghosts, over ghosts that broke my heart before I met you. Lover, please do not fall to your knees. It's not like I believe in everlasting love.
I like to think that I was like a sophisticated, intelligent teenager. There's a 0% chance I could have made anything that smart or like beautiful at 18 years old.
It was beautiful. And it rhymed still. Did you catch there was some rhyming in there?
Yeah, I told you. Rhymed poetry is for children.
It's all about priorities, Steele. You could have put away NBA Live and tried your hand at songwriting.
Maybe I would have won the championship with the Bucks. All right, so that was the first round. Those were songs by teenagers. The second round are going to be songs about young people in praise of immortal youth.
I'm excited about mine. I think this song, if we were having a competition, this one wins. It's a big star. It's called 13, and it just beautiful, beautiful representation of being 13.
Won't you let me walk you home from school? Won't you let me meet you at the pool? Maybe Friday I can get tickets for the dance. Now take you, ooh. Won't you tell your dad, get off my back? Tell him what we said about painted black.
That is a great song, Dave. Alex Chilton, Dead Too Soon. What a genius.
So, I knew that song from the Wilco cover. Is that how you discovered that song, Dave?
Yeah, I know. I've heard Jeff Tweedy sing that song a bunch of times. But yeah, the original's just terrific.
Gorgeous. This one is a reggae classic by a legend Jamaican musician, Peter Tosh. And the song is called You Can't Blame the Youth.
Teaching youths to learn in school, that cow jump over moon. You're teaching youths to learn in school, that the fish run away with spoon. So you can't blame the youth
when they don't learn.
You can't fool, You can't blame the youth
of today.
You can't fool the youth. You teach the youth about Christopher Columbus, and you said he was a very great man. You teach the youth about Marco Polo, and you said he was a very great man. You teach the youth about the pirate Hawkins, and you said he was a very great man. You teach the youth about the pirate Morgan, and you said he was a very great man. So you can't blame the youth of today. You can't fool the youth.
It's one of the most upbeat indictments of how society teaches its youth about what constitutes greatness you'll ever hear.
It's hard being a kid. It's not easy.
Yeah.
That's great. It's tough to follow a reggae song because I feel like it puts you in the mood, and then it's like anything else is just not satisfying.
Yeah, well, definitely play something sad for us here, Spence. We know you're good for it.
Yeah, I'm going to have a tough time following up both of those songs, but fortunately, I think Cat Stevens is up to the task.
Yeah, he is.
This is Father and Son.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young. That's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me. I am old, but unhappy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow.
that your dreams may not.
How can I try to explain? That's a bearded man who feels things, Spence.
Yeah, it's a great song.
I love the premise of that song, and I think about that was one of the records my parents had that I listened to as a kid, and I have all of these fantastic musical memories of my father and my mother's record collections, and them either having songs that they loved and listened to, or a lot of them were like these ballad songs about fathers trying to tell their kids something, like Elton John and Harry Chapin and this. And I'm just thinking about like how important it is for me right now, having a young son, playing music for him and sharing music, and how much I'm looking forward to that, like teaching my son and loving music together with him and recommending songs and seeing him discover stuff that's just beautiful and like that I loved and that he might love. That's one of the great joys, I think, of being a parent. I just think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Guys, I think that song was kind of a perfect introduction to what I want to read for book wisdom today.
Yeah.
So, Spence, have you read The Road by Cormac McCarthy?
No, I've read Blood Meridian, I think.
Okay. Probably earlier this week or last week, I emailed Steele like with exclamation marks saying like you need to read this as soon as possible. I've read it. This is the third time I read it, but this is the first time I've read it since I've had children, and just every page is just almost overwhelming. I'm almost breaking into tears sitting at my lunch break at work. But the basic idea is it's a father and son, and it's a post-apocalyptic world, and they're trying to travel south because winter's coming. And I just want to read one of the sections. What's just happened is they've gone into a house, and they've broken a lock off a door, and behind the door they find lots of naked, starving people. And that someone's obviously caught these people to do them harm and to eat them. And so I'm going to read what happens as they run out the house. They tore through the house to the front door and down the steps. Halfway down the drive, he dragged the boy into the field. He looked back. They were partly screened by the ruins of the privet, but he knew they had minutes at most, and maybe no minutes at all. At the bottom of the field, they crashed through a stand of dead cane and out into the road and crossed into the woods on the far side. He redoubled his grip on the boy's wrist. "Run," he whispered. "We have to run." He looked toward the house, but he could see nothing. If they came down the drive, they would see him running through the trees with the boy. This is the moment. This is the moment. He fell to the ground and pulled the boy to him. "Shh," he said, "shh. Are they going to kill us, Papa? Shh." They lay in the leaves and the ash with their hearts pounding. He was going to start coughing. He'd have put his hand over his mouth, but the boy was holding on to it and would not let go. And in the other hand, he was holding the pistol. He had to concentrate to stifle the cough, and at the same time, he was trying to listen. He swung his chin through the leaves, trying to see. "Keep your head down," he whispered. "Are they coming?" "No." They crawled slowly through the leaves toward what looked like lower ground. He lay listening, holding the boy. He could hear them in the road talking. Voice of a woman. Then he heard them in the dry leaves. He took the boy's hand and pushed the revolver into it. "Take it," he whispered. "Take it." The boy was terrified. He put his arm around him and held him. His body's so thin. "Don't be afraid," he said. "If they find you, you're going to have to do it. Do you understand?" "Shh, no crying. Do you hear me? You know how to do it. You put it in your mouth and point it up. Do it quick and hard. Do you understand? Stop crying. Do you understand?" "I think so." "No, do you understand?" "Yes." "Say yes, I do, Papa. Yes, I do, Papa." He looked down at him. All he saw was terror. He took the gun from him. "No, you don't," he said. "I don't know what to do, Papa. I don't know what to do. Where will you be?" "It's okay. I don't know what to do." "Shh, I'm right here. I won't leave you." "You promise?" "Yes, I promise. I was going to run to try and lead them away, but I can't leave you." "Papa." "Shh, stay down. I'm so scared." "Shh."
Yeah, Dave, I'm reading that book soon, and I'm going to cry a lot.
It's a very dark book. But the soul of it is just this love between father and son. It's actually, when you read it, it's very emotional, but it's very hopeful. And just the relationship between this father and son, it's so strong. And obviously, it makes you think of your relationship with your kids.
We had a moment this last week, Dave, where Laurel and I were just in the bedroom with Cedar. He was playing with his toys, and I was playing music. We were starting to talk about things, and I played this song that my dad used to play, an Elton John song. It's called The Last Song, and it's about a son dying of AIDS and his father coming to visit him and loving him and being willing to accept him and hold him, even though the son didn't think he would because he had presumably contracted HIV through a gay relationship that his dad didn't understand or approve of. And I remember this song, like, from a child, my dad playing it, and like the chorus is about like misjudging the love that a father has for a son. And just thinking about the message that I felt from my dad about like how much he loved me, and then seeing, you know, I have my own son here in this room, and thinking about that, like passing those generations on, it moved me to tears, you know. And I played another song for Laurel that's kind of my version of that song. It's the Chris Staples song, Dark Side of the Moon. I don't know if either of you guys know the song.
Yeah.
And it's one of those moments when I really thought big picture about what I'm passing on from my father and what it means to me to be a father and how glad I am to have this and how much it matters to me. We're really, really lucky to be parents.
I've been reading this book, and it's been great for me, because I remember one night this week I just got mad at my girls and I didn't tell them any stories when it was time for bed. I was too angry, and it was just ridiculous. Like, why am I allowing my anger to control how much I love my daughters at that moment? And it was the next day when I was reading the book at my lunch break at work.
Oh, no.
I wanted to cry just thinking about how much this man loves his son, how much I love my daughters, and just allowing just something as dumb as anger to interrupt that for even a moment, you know?
Yeah. That's a great message. In praise of youth, please, whoever you are, wherever you are, take care of the young people around you. Love them well. Protect them.
Well, this was a great time. I enjoyed talking to both of you guys. This was probably one of my favorite ones we've done. It was great.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Spencer. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
We got a dog, by the way.
That sounds like a mistake, Spencer. Was this the wife's idea?
Yeah, she was rescued from a transport that was taking her to slaughter from Thailand.
In time. Way to go, buddy.
Yeah, Vin Diesel stopped the train and then searched the cars, saved the puppies.
And the dude loves puppies. He's not going to let one puppy go to waste or come to harm.